righty, here we go. Thank you, Aaron. Appreciate it. There comes the wooden wagon. We can't wait to see what the teeny tiny lady has got helping her. She's in a big glass pickle jar. She needs somebody to hold on to her. From here, I don't see her.
Uh-oh.
Sean?
Yeah.
Where is the teeny tiny?
Well, it's unfortunate, but Chris and I, sitting and producing today, he told me in private, so I probably shouldn't be saying it here, that he and the little lady...
No, it's okay, you're safe, go ahead.
That he and the little lady had an argument this morning, and they just haven't been able to settle it, so she's off pouting on her tuffet somewhere.
Okay, all right.
I don't know if Chris feels... I don't know what his...
Well, he's also high on this vaccine thing he's in now. He didn't care about anybody, just himself.
Anticipation is
I'm
high.
Johnson & Johnson. Lifesaver dive, so I can get up in time to say, hey, Hannah, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hello.
Glad to be here.
So you come to us, of course, with good news.
Of course. What is it? What good news?
Good news is we now have a new czar. I'm at the old czar, just as good as the new czar. We've got a new czar, and the new czar in charge of homelessness. Now, this guy, or gal, not even sure, is going to solve the problem.
They go by they, them pronouns.
Oh,
this
okay.
is Mark Jones, and I first heard about Mark Jones a couple of years ago when they were the county and the city of Seattle, used him as a consultant for the kind of setting up the structure of the Regional Homeless Authority, which now they have been named as the first CEO of. Of course, there was another CEO that they offered the job to. That person did not want it, and Mark Jones was the number two. And they have been criticized by some, called a radical, a socialist. People have written about some of his views and some of his tweets and been really critical about it. When we sat down last week, they were quick to acknowledge some of those criticisms as it relates to this new gig.
I understand that there have been some comments about my personal views, and I want to sort of lay out from the beginning, right, that my personal views are not policy. That's not how we govern. How we govern is we agree to do things together, and then we do that thing. And so that's going to be my commitment as the leader of the authority and in architecting the authority's first actions.
Now, as far as their thinking on homelessness response, they say it's important all in the county understand that this is not just about Seattle.
I want to sort of push back on that narrative broadly, right? That like there's a Seattle problem and then everybody else has different problems. We, the region, have a problem. And we, the region, have to supply the resources necessary to solve that problem.
They say
the response is necessary for Black Diamond, for Carnation, right? Like those are responses that are going to be driven by the texture of the locality. Again, might there be disagreements? I suspect yes. But they won't be at the scale of we're moving 1,000 people to this one place.
Now, one of the big issues with this whole regional homeless authority, first of all, it's already like 7 months behind schedule because of the pandemic, and they're trying to play catch up. Mm-hmm. They have a lot of work to do even to get off the ground, figure out how many homeless there are in the county, all of that. And what they said was that the suburban cities have had an issue, trust issues, really from the get-go. There's been a couple of different things. Even at the start of the pandemic, we saw Del Constantine kind of unilaterally sending large groups of homeless people to hotels in cities that were not aware. So a lot of trust issues. And they worry that they won't get a voice. But Doan says,
this is not about Seattle, right? This is about all of us. And the solutions that we craft and how we implement those solutions also has to be about all of us. There are significant gaps right now between understandings and agreement and symmetry between the sort of regional policymakers, and we'll have to work to bridge those. But that's possible, right? Like, we can bring people to the table and have the right conversation to get to the solutions that are going to work for all of us, and most importantly, work for the people who are experiencing homelessness.
Now, one strategy he will continue to push
is the importance of listening to people who are experiencing homelessness. We're really fortunate to have a system that has enshrined people with lived experience in powerful positions on my board, the implementation board, and then also on the governing committee. But that isn't the end of it, right? We have to continue to engage people who are experiencing homelessness, unsheltered homelessness, vehicular homelessness, in shelters, who are accessing programs, to understand what are we doing right? What are we doing wrong? What can we do better? I am not, and I don't think the authority will ever take the position of saying that housing, right, isn't the primary solution that we should be chasing. That's what solves homelessness, is housing. And so a lot of our work is going to be figuring out how to engineer those successful connections with housing resources and acknowledging when those resources don't exist. And we will then continue to develop, you know, what interim solutions we can, but always in partnership with people who have that experience and can guide us in making the right decisions.
Now, here's what he says the problem has been.
We try to build solutions for, you know, 1,500, 2,000, 4,000 people all in one go. And I actually don't think that's the best way to approach this. I think that we need to be looking at building solutions for 30 people, for 20 people, for sometimes 6 people, right? And those are frankly much easier to think about from a design perspective, and frankly much more realistic in terms of what we have at our fingertips to turn online.
And so one thing he said was that congregate shelters like the DESC down in downtown Seattle, that's just not something that works. And pretty much said we can call that the time for those are over.
Wait a minute. The time for what is over?
Congregate shelters where you've got all kinds of homeless people in one.
Together.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So this. This guy, you know, I mean, he's saying all the right optimistic things. It reminds me of the beginning of the Mariners season. You know, everyone, okay, this is how it's all going to work. And they don't seem to acknowledge the difficulties that await them. But I guess my first question would be, when you talked to him, had that Compassion Seattle group
come? No, it was okay. The day before that. But okay. I will say, though, because yes. I was under the impression that was not a secret, that was going to happen.
Okay.
So I would suspect that they knew about that already.
I'm just wondering how they jive.
Yeah.
Their vision and the Compassion Seattle vision.
I think somewhat similarly. And I will say when I was on with the people from Compassion Seattle, I asked them about what about the regional homeless authority. And they said, no, they totally envisioned working with that whole organization. And they want that.
Hannah, in 20 seconds, explain the Compassion for people who don't know.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. The Compassion Seattle is the charter amendment to the city of Seattle's basically constitution. They're going to try to get signatures, put it on the ballot that would basically make Seattle have to act on homelessness. Right. They would have to 2,000 beds and do a lot of other things.
They need 30,000 signatures by June in order to get this as a vote to be able to step over the city council and then have the people decide where the money goes and directing it towards the homeless problem, which, by the way, it was 2015 or something, and we declared it an emergency, didn't we?
Mm-hmm. It was, yeah, Ed Murray did it. Yeah. So, yeah, it's been a while, 6 years,
well,
I think. Yeah.
Well. Turned it into an emergency.
I want to say, in answer to your question, Tom, that I did ask Mark Jones, because I, in my opinion, having covered this forever here, politics just gets in the way, gets involved, it's a problem. I said, are you worried about politics? And they came out and he just said, no way ever will we, the Regional Homeless Authority, take any position on any ballot measure, he said specifically, or any, you know, candidate or anything like that. So I suspect that the two might work well together.
And it's an interesting choice, this person, Mark Jones. He's a social entrepreneur, policy strategist, social justice activist with 10 years of experience in equitable systems and transformation across local, state, and federal government systems.
More racial equity activists than they are a, you know, homeless expert necessarily.
Right. He comes out from Ohio. He was a faculty member of the School of Visual Arts. Wow, about that. Yeah. So there we are. That's there you go. Has a psychiatrist anthropology degree there in New York University. So he gets a chance to get into the barrel, get spun around a couple times here in Seattle. We'll see how he enjoys it.
And I will say, Tom, that he also said that he wanted to manage expectations, and there's no quick fix to any of this. No. they were very excited about some of the funding that we've got from the latest stimulus bill that's going directly to homelessness. There's going to be a lot coming from the state budgets that we're doing right now as well. So there's stuff on the horizon, but it's not going to happen quickly.
I just imagine, though, because I think there's a lot of hope for this Compassion Seattle thing, if there's a city charter amendment, a city charter amendment that forces 12% of the budget to go to that. That is going to be a little awkward when you've got Seattle committed to something and then you're working with the other, you know, cities in the region that don't have that. I want to say
I asked about that when I was on with the Compassion Seattle people, because it was all about they had an existing 12% of the general fund budget from the 2020 budget that they were looking at, which means the RHA money, the homelessness money for the Regional Homeless Authority has already been in the 2020 budget, it's already set aside for that. So I think Seattle still has some of its own independent homeless dollars to begin with every year. So it may come from that pot.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking, if Seattle's committed to 12%, will that mean Bellevue has to be committed to 12% and, you know, Black Diamond? Wherever people
are. No, because it's only for Seattle, right? That charter
amendment would only impact them, not everyone. Exactly. But if you're the regional director and you're trying to get all these cities to work together, Seattle's going to say, hey, we're putting in 12% of our budget. How about you guys?
Also part of that regional thing is because people would say, well, hold on a second, you're coming in from Burien to come to Seattle to take advantages of our thing. So then it's like, hold on, and we're going to, everybody's going to have to pay. So everybody throws in. That way everyone's equally being, you know, disadvantaged by the fact that the homeless person can move to where the free stuff is as they want to come to Seattle, because wherever is the best, you got the best stuff, you'll go there for the best handouts.
They actually said that. Mark Jones said exactly what you just said in the
sit-down like, that I had with them. I like Mark then. Good. Way to go, Mark.
You guys are on the same page, John.
Welcome. Anything else, Hannah, you want to throw onto the table?
Sure, I got all kinds of stuff. So we're still talking. We're talking about the Blake decision, which you wanted to know about.
Ah,
and I know you had, there was a hearing about this bill today. And it, you know, this is, the Blake decision is the state Supreme Court's throwing out of our drug possession law, which kind of just created all this chaos early in session. I think it was back in February. It basically left us with no law on the books, and they have to go back and retro, but they maybe have to vacate sentences from back all the way to 71. There's a whole lot of fines and fees that have to be refunded to people. It's a big mess, but in the meantime we need some sort of law. So there's some competing proposals. There's a few moderate Democrats and Republicans who have proposed putting the law, the word knowingly back in there, which was the issue, which would basically just make a drug possession law be on the books again in our state. For the most part, the middle of the road bill from Monka Dingra is the one that seems to be getting the traction. It's the one that had a hearing today. It's very much like the bill, like what Oregon did recently with their legalization of small amounts. It is based on the threshold for the amounts are the same as Oregon would be, which vary depending on the drugs. And it's 21 that creates a gross misdemeanor, though. So there is a crime that is committed for this if you're above that threshold. And that was where some of the pushback came at the hearing I heard this morning. But most of the people there in favor of this bill, and they explained why it was needed.
This bill provides a minimum statewide standard of protection from this punishment. This is an important step, and also we know more is needed to undo the war on drugs. To build a true system of care, we need expanded investments so people struggling with substance use can get help when, where, and how they need it.
2 weeks after my 18th birthday, I was arrested as I was leaving a motel where I was staying, and I had a shoplifting warrant, and I also had $20 worth of heroin in my pocket. In jail, I detoxed from heroin and was released 56 days later, returning to a life of addiction.
I believe that the time and money spent during the 8 years it took me to get through the court system and my incarceration had been used for treatment and recovery services, my son would have had his mom back at 8 years old instead of 15.
So would have made a difference. A lot of people saying the current system doesn't work. The war on drugs did not work. People lose their ability to get jobs, their housing, get better, get treatment, all of that. But there were still others who came to speak against the bill.
The appropriate fix for this. We believe that it's going to potentially create a legalization for those that distribute legend drugs, and that the unintended consequences of that are going to be unforeseen. Further, we believe that it victimizes the users even more so, because there's not going to be the ability to stop those that are distributing it from doing so. The major concern in the amounts that are being shown is the 40 pills of fentanyl. We all know we're in the middle of a opiate crisis, and our fentanyl overdoses are through the roof, and we believe that this bill is going to help exacerbate that.
And the 40 pills is that threshold that's specific to the fentanyl pills in this bill that you're considered in that small amount range if you just have 40 of those, and those are pretty deadly. So that was his pushback.
I had seen this, Hannah. I saw this morning. This is from Reason. They picked this up from the Washington Post. They're looking at Baltimore, and they said between March 2020 and March 2021, violent crime in Baltimore dropped 20%. Property crime dropped 36%. Homicides were down, although they're about even where they were last year. But what they're saying is that we decided, the attorney general there in Baltimore said, we're not going to be able, we're going to let people out of prison. We've got this problem with this COVID stuff, so we're not going to be able to bring people in. We're not going to hit them with misdemeanors and drugs and all this other, you know, minor stuff, peeing in public and all that. They just stop charging for all that. And now someone is saying and trying to make the connection, well, because you stopped all that, violent crime is down.
And I think you'll probably hear some making that argument here. And you've already heard some of the people making that argument here. Dan Satterberg for a long time about, his 1 gram or less policy that he's had for a few years has made a difference. And diversion that he's got in his office has made a difference. Mm-hmm. And it has to some degree for some. And the other big part of this conversation is that if you look at the numbers, there are the war on drugs affected people of color more than it did not people of color. Mm-hmm. So there was, and that's the big thing right now, is that they're trying to undo some of this harm. And again, people couldn't get housing. They couldn't get all of the things that they need. They have no chance when they come out, and they were busted for, you know, a small amount of weed back in like the 70s. There were 4 or 5 guys still in our state doing like 65 years for that just a couple of years ago that they finally vacated. But that's what they're trying to undo. So why not do this instead of busting somebody for just a small amount of drugs? Go ahead and divert them for treatment. There's something in the law that, takes care of it. If it's a minor, there are different things that happen. Something has to happen, though, because if you don't put the word knowingly back in, there's no law in the books. So they have to do something.
Got it.
Yeah, that Baltimore information is fascinating. Yeah. I hope that bears out, but they do acknowledge the pandemic year, you know, nobody quite knows what impact pandemic aspect of this year had on the crime. It might not be related to the decriminalization.
We'll see.
And I can say here the crime went up across the board. Domestic violence, murder,
violent
shootings,
crime?
All of it, way up.
Well,
Then
that's good for Baltimore then.
All right, Hannah, thank you. See what happens in Seattle, more decriminalization. On the roadways, are we all right? Write to us at MyNorthwest.com. Chris Martin can't wait to get those letters. He has to choose letter of the day all on his own because of a bit of a tiff between he and the teeny tiny. We won't need to go into it. It was probably about vaccinating, wasn't it? Was that what it was that you brought that up? Yes. She what? She hasn't gotten
it. Was upset that she hasn't got it yet.
You know, why isn't she on the list?
Maybe she's too young.
Imagine what that needle would do to her, though. Major League Baseball suddenly very concerned about voting in Georgia, and they said, you know what, we are going to take the big classic that nobody cares about anymore anyway, and we're going to pull it out of Georgia because it's terrible down there, and we're going to move it somewhere else. And now they have to find some other place because now they really got themselves a bit of a pickle, speaking of teeny tiny. This is the NBC with the news.
Baseball is known as America's national pastime, but MLB declared what it's seeing in Georgia right now decidedly un-American, reacting to a polarizing package of voting laws by pulling the plug on the All-Star game in Atlanta. Commissioner Rob Manfred writing, the decision will demonstrate our values as a sport. Major League Baseball.
What values? Are those the same values that has it doing a deal with China and Cuba? Those values?
Fundamentally supports voting rights for all
Rubio?
Americans.
No, just pointing out the little inconsistencies. That's... By the way, he's not finished, Tom. You're not allowed to interrupt him.
Fundamentally supports voting rights for all Americans and opposes restrictions to the ballot box. Georgia Governor Brian Kemp firing back late Friday on Fox News.
Major League Baseball has folded up and caved to the cancel culture. And a bunch of liberal lies, quite honestly. And
shockwaves from the decision now rippling through the Braves' home county.
While I certainly am disappointed that Major League Baseball has decided to pull the All-Star game from Cobb County, Georgia, I certainly do understand.
The social stand coming with economic repercussions.
Yeah, I don't know how many millions of dollars and how many jobs they're affected by it. So where are they? Have they announced they're going to go? They can't go to New Jersey, because if you just want to do, like, You want to line them up. New Jersey, New York, Connecticut, Delaware. The best choice for them is to come to Seattle. If you look at Seattle, pretty good voter turnout. Not quite as good as Georgia, but still pretty good. We have a mail-in ballot, right? We do give you a lot of chances to be able to have absentee. So, I don't know if we have
a Republican Secretary of State.
Right. So
who supports
I'm
it.
Here. People hungry to see baseball. Somebody wins, somebody loses, right? And I don't know. The problem is, King Inslee let people go to the game? That's the question, right?
So, yeah, John, I don't know if you heard the bottom of the news.
I heard it, Tom. I was listening. Yeah. That's Aaron's got that story.
That's Pramila Jayapal.
Yeah.
You know, the head of the Progressive Caucus Democrats in the House is calling for it to happen here. I think this would be great. We haven't seen great baseball in so many years. I think it would be fantastic if we got the All-Star game here.
Yeah.
I don't know what the latest is. Right now, I think we have a cap at 9,000.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, you know, where I know, like during the World Series last year, they had a restricted number of people, but my guess is there are stadiums in certain states that probably would allow for more.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know where, I'm not quite sure where MLB stands on the COVID stuff, if that's a concern, because Texas, I think, says, hey, we're wide open, but Texas is also going through a series of, voting, you know, changes that might clash with MLB values as well.
Well, looking head-to-head, just going against it just as far as restrictions on voting, Washington Town comes in with 18 days for absentee. You got Georgia just one behind at 17. You've got New Jersey in way behind at 9. I guess they're more racist there. And then I'm looking to find out about ID. Here's the really cool thing. If you were to go to the Major League Baseball and go to the game, you're going to need to present ID when you go to the window, the will call window. What they found was about 2,200 and some ballots got thrown out because the signatures didn't match. And then because you're sitting there looking at the signatures, how about this one compared to this one? And in most cases, a lot of the signatures got thrown out were from black people. I don't know maybe Fulton County or something like that. So then they said, let's just say, how about this? It's a number on a piece of paper on your ballot that also corresponds to either your driver's license, to the ID we give you, or the other number. You can even put down your utility bill. And then I read about why they had this thing for water and things. It got really interesting where the people were showing up and giving out pizza. It's called electioneering. In line, and they can't do pizza and water and T-shirts and bumper stickers. When you get closer and closer to the building, there is water provided by non-service. It's not provided by anybody. And when they were debating this bill coming forward, a lot of the stuff they were reading from the floor, both Republicans and Democrats, were from Stacey Abrams, who says that she is actually the governor, that she, even though she lost by 50-some thousand votes, they were reading chunks of what she had been saying we need to do this and we need to do that. And one Republican said, how would people feel about Proud Boys going down the line handing water out to people? Would anybody like that idea? Or you think that people would feel intimidated by Proud Boys wearing whatever they wear, handing water out? They said, that's an example of why we don't want you electioneering pizzas and water and T-shirts and bumper stickers and anything else.
Yeah.
No one's allowed next to anybody, but you can still go ahead, go up to the thing. You can get an umbrella. You can go get water that's going to be there non-serviced. It's provided by the county that's doing, you know, the balloting and everything. But this is the story that
the
Republicans need you to push, that Georgia is a racist state. They're trying to stop black people from voting. They had a higher turnout than New Jersey and New York itself. You can't do it. What's that, Tom?
No, I know. I mean, that may be true, but the reason they're doing this, that's what makes this whole thing suspect.
Oh, really? Why is that?
Because it's the Republicans that decided to change the voting laws after Trump lost two Senate seats. So the impulse behind this, it might not be, as I was saying last week, it might not be racist as much as it's anti-democratic.
They were hitting
up the things that allowed or occasioned more black voting.
Right.
And that's what's really tricky about this is that if Trump had won Georgia and the two senators had gone Republican like everyone expected, there wouldn't have been any of these vote changes. The vote changes.
Well, we don't know that. We don't know that. I think it's pretty clear.
Really,
hey, do me a favor. Send me the website that says that and shows that. I'd love to read it. But if it's your opinion that this is done because Trump lost, that's your opinion. But to say that it's pretty clear, it's tough. Where's the website?
By facts.
So, the facts. So if we're going to do straight across the board comparison, you want to compare New Jersey to Georgia? You want to compare New York? How about Delaware?
It's not. Georgia is designed to improve Republican turnout and depress Democratic turnout. I don't care
what happens in New Jersey. Where's that, Tom? Where's that study?
I don't know if you want to go into the time, but we can look at it. Why did they originally decide they were going to not allow for voting on Sunday? Because that was when the big black push was.
The state was silent on Sundays. They wrote it into the law. Tom, if you want to go across the board, look at the numbers and compare Georgia with the ability to vote with 18 or 17 days of absentee. Plus, they have two Saturdays. Delaware does not have that.
I know, but you need to change.
Tom, it's different.
If Delaware changed their vote to make it easier for one particular group of people and depress the others, that would be the problem. It's not how much they allow for. Uh-huh. It's what the impulse behind those change is designed to do. That's all.
Okay, so then I guess we'll see it, right? In 2 years, we're going to see less black turnout?
Yes, unless there's more backlash out there. That's why a lot of Republicans are saying this was a mistake.
I'll say this.
Because this is going to enrage the blacks enough that they'll turn out and vote. They had the highest vote turnout this last time out because they were so insulted by the way things have been going with
this. This is a lie that is being told by Joe Biden, as proved by the fact checkers at the Washington Post that gave him four Pinocchios. They need to keep this going because they have to push H.R. 1. So they race it on the back of race. And it's all about the fact that this is the lie that is being pushed by Democrats. You get Coca-Cola to cave. You get Delta to cave. And you get Major League Baseball to cave.
Why would they cave if it's not based on anything of a real heft and merit?
Right.
It's fascinating that they do this.
Yep. Yeah.
I mean, the thing is, the Republican legislature gets to override the Secretary of State.
Yep.
And the elections board. If that had happened when Trump was still in office, when he was trying to find those votes, he could have very well flipped the election. We've got to make sure that doesn't happen.
If you're listening to me, you hear me, this is a gigantic lie. Don't believe it coming out of Georgia. And by the way, check the Washington Post for Pinocchios from Mr. Biden. Traffic?
Not as big a lie as that Trump won the election.
Sean, for you, you only have to play just, I think, two notes of the mailman, please.
All right. We call it sometimes tippy-top shape.
All right, well, you do, former President Trump, but we can't find teeny tiny. Tom, we'll get to letter of the day, as chosen by Chris Martin all by himself. Let's take care of all the rest. Here we go.
Okay, a lot of good letters here. Talking about the infrastructure bill right off the bat, 253 says, here's an infrastructure question.
Uh-huh.
Why should the folks in Spokane help pay for the aging WS ferry system that allows folks to commute from Bainbridge to Seattle?
Uh-huh.
I think it's part of the highway system, actually.
I think it is. Okay. Let's see. It's the wet highway. The American infrastructure is not crumbling. Are you kidding me, John? Where the hell are you getting your information? I have friends and families that work on roads and bridges, and they know they're falling apart. They're dangerous.
And 253, hey, John, let's do a bill where the states keep their own money.
Uh-huh.
That way, Kentucky and the other money-sucking red states can finance their own projects.
Yeah.
That way, when a hurricane comes through Florida, Alabama, et cetera, they're on their own.
Yeah. We have, you know, currently, companies don't do business in places like Ireland. They use the tax shelter to boost and dodge U.S. taxes. The average Irish person sees nothing in terms of job creation. These companies, Hong Kong is a giant money laundering center. It isn't because of lack of rules. It's there because lack of rules. All right.
And 206, libertarians don't want government to go away. Uh-huh. Libertarians want to control government with lots of money. They're basically capitalist anarchists.
Huh. Question for Curly. If the U.S. lower the corporate tax rates to reflect that of some Asian countries, does that mean all the inexpensive labor would come here too?
Great. More low-paying jobs in America. Okay.
On the controversial issue of how did Frazier live in Seattle?
Hold on a second. That wasn't even a question, that person, 253. They stated all that, but they never put a question mark at the end. All right, go ahead, Tom. Sorry.
Well, there's a, would come to, would the expense of labor come to? And then he makes this good crack. Okay, now on the Frazier business. Mm-hmm. Frazier was able to afford the apartment because he had stocks and investments. Do you really think a smart doctor like Frazier would not have invested his money wisely?
Yes, come on. But 206 says both Frazier and his brother Niles were published authors, hence the famous psychiatrist on the radio. Oh.
Already.
All right.
Oh, I threw up twice.
It's chosen by Chris. Martin. Letter of the day, Tom.
Letter of the day comes from area code 425. Why don't you guys stop talking once in a while and comment on some of your emails and your text messages? You guys talk too GD much.
Sorry to the kids out there.
That's all she wrote.
That's all she said. She cut many expletives out of the letters. There was lots and lots of cursing today.
Sorry, 425.
Sorry.